You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Paul Passananti, and I represent the appellant, Dr. Richard Hoover, in this appeal of an order granting a motion to dismiss a petition. I would remind the court that this case was decided before any discovery was done. It was decided on the basis of the allegations in the petition and a motion to dismiss saying that the petition didn't state a claim under the Merchandising Practices Act.
A lot of dedication in the briefing and in the prior Court of Appeals decisions dealing with the issue of whether or not this was converted to a summary judgment. And the judge on the appellate court, my charge with the judge, it clearly says that the court granted the motion to dismiss. So why doesn't that tell me, as somebody who's reviewing the trial court's decision, that regardless of what the lawyers attached to pleadings or argued to the court, that this particular court didn't consider it in the allegations because it just granted the motion to dismiss. If this court had intended to convert that motion to a motion for summary judgment, then the order it granted would be a motion for a judgment sustaining the summary judgment. And why does it go even past that? In other words, I don't have to listen to what the lawyers tell me about this case because the judge merely granted the motion to dismiss.
Judge, that's absolutely correct. I will never forget standing in front of the Court of Appeals and Judge Crane asking me why this wasn't a case that should be construed as being decided on summary judgment. And I was dumbfounded. I was dumbfounded because the case law establishes clearly that if a motion to dismiss is going to be converted into a motion for summary judgment, the parties are entitled to notice that the trial court is going to do that. The case law establishes that if a motion to dismiss is going to be converted into a motion for summary judgment, that the procedures applicable to summary judgment under Rule 74.04 are to be followed. None of that was done in this case. The first time someone suggested that this was a summary judgment case was during oral argument in the Court of Appeals. There is no basis under the law for this particular case to be construed as one involving summary judgment.
Or if the trial judge wanted to be judged by those standards, they could have easily said, I grant the motion that was converted to a motion for summary judgment. But clearly here, the message from the trial judge is, file what you want. All I considered was the allegations, and I sustained the motion.
And Judge, absolutely. And what I would point out is that in the Court of Appeals opinion by Judge Crane, she said, we're going to call this summary judgment, but she sustained a motion to dismiss. So that particular aspect of the case, and let me say this. As I enter the twilight of my career, I realize how blessed I am to be able to appear in the courts of our state and on those very special occasions appear before this court and argue on behalf of my clients. No one has more gratitude for this privilege than I do. But sometimes, because of my upbringing or something, my comments are construed as disrespectful. And I assure you that I do not disrespect the Court of Appeals judges that issued this opinion. But it was wrong. It was clearly wrong. It was an attempt to find a way to do exactly what the law doesn't allow. On a motion to dismiss, the allegations in the petition are to be taken as true. And we alleged that this particular hospital system charges the uninsured far more than a fair and reasonable amount for the services that they provide. The judges on the Court of Appeals decided the opposite, that that allegation was not true, that this plaintiff had not paid more than a fair and reasonable amount. And the Court of Appeals did that without any evidence whatsoever to support it. Yes, we agreed that that Dr. Hoover signed a financial responsibility agreement. Yes, we agreed that the charges were $17,000 or something. Yes, we agreed that Dr. Hoover only paid $5,300. But there was no evidence anywhere in the trial court, in the legal file, as to what the fair and reasonable charge should be. How could the Court of Appeals decide that what he paid was fair and reasonable without any evidence from any experts as to what is fair and reasonable?
Was the contract attached to the petition?
I am not sure if the contract was attached to the petition, Judge, but I am sure that during the course of the briefing on the motion to dismiss, the financial responsibility agreement was part of the memos of law in support or in opposition to the motion to dismiss. There's no dispute about that agreement.
The dissenting opinion of Judge Moody focused on what your client pled. That did not anything that in fact, contrary to what the majority found, your client pled that the amount he had paid there was not a fair and reasonable charge. Can you tell me exactly the claim stated?
Well, Judge, here's what the pleading stated. Judge Mooney said, we alleged that the plaintiff had sustained damages. And we did that in summary fashion in paragraph 46 of the amended petition. We said in paragraph 46 of the amended petition that he paid more than a fair and reasonable amount for the services. In paragraphs 39A through S, paragraph 40, paragraph 41, paragraph 42, A through F, paragraph 43, A through H, paragraph 44, and paragraph 45, we alleged facts to show how and why the amount that he paid wasn't fair and reasonable.
How much you had paid and what amount was roughly fair and reasonable charge for that device?
No, we did not allege what the fair and reasonable charge was, Your Honor. And the reason that we didn't allege that is because that is a matter for expert testimony. Those paragraphs that I just cited to the court establish this. Hospitals establish a standard or charge master rate. It's up here. It's the highest rate. Medicare pays much less. Health insurance carriers pay much less than the standard rate. The standard charge is only paid by the uninsured, or at least charged to the uninsured. It's the charge that is least likely to be paid. We haven't said, because we haven't conducted any discovery, we haven't identified any experts, we haven't evaluated, okay, let's look at this situation. Medicare pays X, health insurance carriers pay A, B, and C, the standard charge is this, what is the fair and reasonable charge? We never got to that point, Your Honor. All we did was plead that it was true, and we went into great detail as to how these charges are set. But no, we didn't say that X amount of dollars is the fair and reasonable amount because, quite honestly, I don't know that. My doctor doesn't know that. That will take some evidence and some discovery. But it's amazing to me that the Court of Appeals could say, okay, he paid $5,300. That's fair and reasonable. He didn't sustain damages. What if he had paid $5,000? What if he had paid $6,000? There was no basis for them to conclude what was fair and reasonable because there was no evidence of that as yet. We merely alleged, as Judge Mooney pointed out, consistent with Scheibel versus Hillis, while plaintiff is required to plead ultimate facts, he is not required to plead the facts or circumstances by which the ultimate facts will be established. I need to identify some experts. I haven't.
What you're saying is the reason we charged $10,000, but you have as good as $4,000.
We have no evidence of that, Your Honor.
Because I'm saying if you develop the evidence, that's what it
would check. The counsel says that question is not what's fair and reasonable, but what you agree to.
Your Honor, the financial responsibility agreement that patients are required to pay says that the patient agrees to pay facility charges.
The opposing counsel says that the cardmaster charged, but is there anything that says that, or does it just say facility charge undefined?
It says facility charges undefined. It does not specify a price. Judge, I cannot emphasize too strongly, and again, I say this with all due respect, I'm just projecting. When a contract does not specify a price, the law says that you're required to pay what is fair and reasonable. To me, an organization like the defendants, which claims everywhere that it's a religious organization, a charitable organization, an organization which enjoys tax-exempt status under both state and federal governments, all we want them to do is charge a fair and reasonable price. They say, well, we can't know what the patient is going to need. Are they going to need an aspirin? Are they going to need this test? Are they going to need that test? I don't know that either. But all we are asking is that they charge patients a fair and reasonable price. Don't charge the uninsured more than you charge everyone else. How can they get up here and say we can charge the uninsured whatever the heck we want, regardless of what Medicare pays, regardless of what health insurance carriers pay? All we want them to do is charge a fair and reasonable price. And my client, the retired head of pathology at St. Louis University, was outraged when he saw what happens to uninsured patients. Now they're going to say, well, he didn't pay $5,300 until the day the lawsuit was filed. I would like to know where it says that it matters when the amount was paid. The answer is nowhere. It doesn't matter when I forced him to pay this amount. They're going to say that they asked me about this in Missouri Lawyers Weekly, and I said that he paid what he thought was reasonable. What was I supposed to say? That he intentionally paid them an amount that he thought was unreasonable? The fact of the matter is that these institutions charge the uninsured amounts far in excess of what they charge others. And all I want is an opportunity to prove that. I want the allegations in my petition to be accepted as true, and I want an opportunity to conduct discovery, and I want an opportunity to go to trial. That's all I ask, and I would end with this. I'm just a trial lawyer. I'm not a constitutional lawyer. My head was spinning earlier. But I do know this. This particular case has ramifications far beyond Dr. Hoover and his bill. The way that hospitals bill patients is ridiculous. And this court has an opportunity to merely say that the judge erred by dismissing this petition and allow me to conduct discovery and take my case to trial. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have time for your vote. Thank you, Mr. Walker.
Thank you, Judge.
Alan Allred, Thompson Coburn, here on behalf of Mercy Hospital St. Louis and the other Mercy defendants. Let me say at the outset that a motion to dismiss, and I think Judge Fisher nailed it, a motion to dismiss tests the legal sufficiency of the complaint. It doesn't even test facts. The problem the plaintiff has here, which was identified by Judge Hartenbach and by two of your colleagues on the Court of Appeals, is that two problems. One, this cause of action is not recognized in Missouri, and it's not recognized in every state from New Hampshire to Arizona that's looked at this.
Do you agree then that the proper standard for this court to apply this case, because it makes it a lot easier to agree that the proper standard for us to apply this case is the one around the sustaining of the motion to dismiss?
Yes, Judge, I think that's fair, and I'm pleased to have you look at it through that perspective. Because, as I started to say, you have the problem, there's no cause of action here. And Freeman addresses that. Your colleagues in the Southern District addressed it.
But Freeman was different, wasn't it? Because in Freeman, the defendant didn't pay any money, unlike in this situation where the defendant did pay.
Freeman didn't hold for the proposition, Your Honor, that you if you don't pay anything, then you've got no cause of action. Freeman said that unless you can show that you paid more than what is the reasonable amount. And in this case, they don't have a cause of action, but they also haven't pled the facts.
Well, assume just for the purpose of this question that what they pled was sufficient, the ultimate fact is they paid more than a fair and reasonable amount. Why was it proper to grant a motion to dismiss? Isn't that an issue for further exploration and maybe summary judgment from any point if they can't support it?
The reason, Your Honor, is clear. He didn't plead sufficient facts. You look at the paragraph that he himself cited in his opening remarks. If you look at the opinion by Judge Crane, who I have to say is a stickler on civil rules because I've served with her on your civil rules committee. She's a stickler, and she looked at section 46, paragraph 46, and she refers to it in her opinion. Plaintiff argues that he sufficiently alleged an ascertainable loss of money in paragraph 46 of his amended petition, in which he alleged, and again, this is conclusory, no fact, as a direct and proximate result of the conduct of defendants and each of them, Hoover paid more for the goods sold than the services rendered than the reasonable value. That's a conclusory statement. And
how detailed do you have to be? What says you have to prove exactly what you should have paid as opposed to showing at this point that you were damaged by paying too much?
Because just as Judge Wilson inquired of counsel when he was up here, they didn't allege that they paid the amount that was actually billed. They didn't allege that they paid the, quote, unreasonable charges. They don't even allege that they paid the standard charges. They don't allege any of that.
And they paid more than a fair and reasonable amount.
Well, what they say is, in one of the paragraphs, they say that, we paid what we thought was reasonable. And then they say, somewhere in one of the allegations, and it's not clear to me, and you'll study this.
Large weekly is not pleading, so it's not pleading.
No, you're exactly right, it's not. But it's also something that was talked about in the various documents that were before the court down in the trial level. And also in the Court of Appeals, Your Honor.
Why doesn't the trial court's order itself tell me it did not consider any of that? Because all that's sustained was the motion to dismiss. If the trial court wanted to consider things outside of pleadings, then they could tell us all and they could grant a motion. But whenever they tell us what they did, that sustained the motion to dismiss, isn't that telling me, at least by implication, that they didn't consider anything outside of the pleadings for purposes of their ruling, or at least that fair shake they want to mean that I don't consider anything outside the pleadings?
Judge, I think you're exactly right that this case falls, this petition or amended petition falls because he didn't plead sufficient facts, a basis for a motion to dismiss, and that there's no cause of action here. He didn't plead a cause of action in Missouri. And that's exactly what the other states that have looked at this have said. That's what five of the trial judges in Greene County and St. Louis County colleagues have said when they've looked at this lawsuit.
Let's talk about that. Let's leave this pleading issue aside. Assume he has pled sufficient facts to state the cause of action he's trying to state. How then would we assess whether or not that's truly a recognized cause of action under the Merchandise Practices Act?
Because he didn't plead an ascertainable loss. There is no loss here that is, first of all, there's nothing here that shows that there was a deception. He doesn't allege, for example, that this was what we told you would pay. Doesn't allege it. He doesn't allege that when you actually billed us that this is different than what you told us we would pay. And he doesn't allege that the amount that he paid is somehow in response to a fraud or a deception or some false pretext. And with regard to the question you pose, Your Honor, you've got to show that you have a right or an entitlement to be the beneficiary of contracts that are negotiated between an insurance company and a hospital, between an individual insured and an insurance company. He can't come in, because if he does, I can guarantee you no one's going to buy insurance anymore.
Isn't
because you can walk in.
Is part of the loss of the reputation due to collection action?
Well, Your Honor, that I think that, first of all, reputation or credit, if you will, issues are not recoverable under the Merchandising Practices Act, because the Merchandising Practices Act case that I cite in my brief goes to the point that you have to show pecuniary or economic loss. And that, and in this case, this type of allegation with regard to what they would claim about his reputation or his credit damage is not pecuniary or economic.
And economic loss was $300 he paid, wasn't it?
Well,
is that ascertainable, that money?
But as you alluded, Your Honor, in the case that you cited Freeman was not about the fact if you don't pay, you lose. Freeman was about the point that you have to show that you have to show in your pleadings that what you paid or didn't pay is more than what the provider was entitled to. And here that's not alleged.
Sorry? Won't that be flushed out in discovery?
But I think you have to allege why it is that the amount that you're saying you paid is more than what would be a reasonable. You have to plead that. Okay? You have to plead why this, and what is it? What is the amount that you would plead is in fact the fair amount.
I urge you to plead what would be a fair amount. That's, you keep coming back to this pleading and
motion to dismiss.
But what says you have to plead what would be fair as opposed to for pleading purposes that you pay more than is fair and reasonable?
Well, they don't plead they even paid the amounts that they're railing against. They don't plead that they paid the standard charges that they quote in their brief. The standard charges. They don't plead that they in fact paid the amount they actually were billed. So, as my point is this: where is the plea?
Well,
the pleading.
They didn't pay what they were billed. That's the whole point. They're saying that was unreasonable, but also what they paid was unreasonable. What says they have to pay the entire billed amount in order to bring a cause of action? Trying to get
Go ahead. Because under the Freeman case, you have to be able to plead what that you paid more than what the, in this case, the provider was entitled to.
And why didn't he include that by saying I paid more than the fair and reasonable value of the services provided, and then you can ask for a more definite statement, you can do discovery, and you may be back in 6 months showing that they haven't, you know, there's no expert testimony to support their claim, but why isn't that sufficient?
Well, you get back to the point that there is no, in this state, and every state that I'm aware of, there may be an exception, but I'm not aware of a state that's looked at this and said that he is entitled to some nebulous number to establish some type of a reasonable value. That's not what he agreed to do. When he signed that contract, he said he would pay the facility charges and the bill charges. And your colleagues on the Indiana Supreme Court, and they rely upon the Court of Appeals in Indiana, which now that decision has been vacated by their Supreme Court and said, we're not going to go down this road. The Merchandising Practices Act is not a piece of legislation to determine price. We'll leave that to the legislature, or we'll leave it to whoever it is other than the courts, because we don't have the resources to say every time someone walks in and says, you know what, I didn't get the price. Someone goes in and buys a Chevy for $30,000, and then they find out that the next week, Enterprise came in, or Hertz, and said, we want to buy 30 Chevys. What kind of price are you going to give me? Well, I'll give you $3,000 off each one. $27,000 deal. You're going to get that class action from that individual who's going to come back and say, he just gave the Hertz guy a deal, $3,000 off each car. Why don't I get that? And I also submit to you, if you go down this road, why would anybody buy insurance? Why not just walk in and get your care through the emergency room, walk out and say, let me see the bill. I'm not paying that. I know a guy that paid half that. And then you've got every hospital in the state that's going to be in the same position. And is that what you want to regulate?
You're going way down.
Well, Well, I know. All I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the question is, he wants to establish some type of a reasonable benchmark that he claims he paid more than, and he can't do that because we don't have a basis here to say he's entitled to that benchmark. That's my point. So
is
I think.
Is that because we don't have evidence, or you're saying evidence couldn't establish
that? Evidence could not establish that, Your Honor, because if you look at the Freeman case, that court looked at every possible cause of action as it said in the decision. Because one, we can't find that he paid more than the quality of the care, because there's other cases like
the. Well,
they said there was no basis for any cause of action under any theory, under any theory, Your Honor, in the Freeman case. And so, you look at that decision. You look at the Indiana case where there was a question about is it reasonable and so forth. And the court said we are not going to go down the road of trying to divine in every individual circumstance with every individual patient.
If I understand your argument, part of it is that there was a contractual agreement to pay a certain amount based upon the state of the facility charges. Was that defined in any place in this
agreement? It says.
We meant the car metric charges, and thereafter you use the car metric charges. So I didn't see anything where a person signing that would know what you're saying they agreed to.
Yes, Your Honor. The charge master, which all hospitals use, is obviously a big book for all the possible charges, from tests to drugs.
But he didn't sign the charges. He signed this agreement that says facility charges. Is that defined any place in the agreement?
Let's be clear on that. If you drop your car off over here to get fixed, and you walk in and say, here's my car, fix it, there's a noise in the back, and you come back later and say, oh, I didn't ask, but you know what, I think your price is unfair. Does that work? You look at the restatement of contracts.
Restatement. Can you answer my specific question?
Well, your specific question is, Your Honor, is that the...
Is there a factual issue here as to what he agreed to pay?
He didn't put the facts in issue because he didn't plead the facts as to what he should pay. That's the point. He never pleaded that either. There's no basis. What is the benchmark? He didn't plead it.
How should you know what he should pay? Or you should pay?
He says, Your Honor.
Somebody could find out maybe the PA cost $2, or maybe it should have cost a dime. So how's he supposed to know that?
Well, first of all, I don't think, and I think this is what your colleagues in over 30 states have decided, that the courts are not going to get into the issue of deciding the health care delivery price system. That's what they're trying to do with the Affordable Care Act. And obviously, our Supreme Court took a look at that after the legislature acted, or some regulatory body. That's not what I would believe your colleagues. I'm not talking just what Alan Allred thinks, but colleagues of yours on states around the country have said, that's not what we're going to get into. So the point is that he says,
you
though he's...
Have the consumer, the actual person paying the bill involved in figuring out the fairness of these bills. He's the actual consumer, and because he's not insured, he's trying to figure it out.
And the consumer can say, I want to know what this bill is going to cost me, or ask the doctor, what is this going to cost me? I don't want to come here. I'm going to go to Missouri Baptist. I'm going to go to Barnes. I'm going to go to St. Mary's in Jefferson City. That's what the consumer does. That's what regulates a price, a market. We can't charge, even though this grandiose statement, we can charge. We can't charge whatever we want. No, we can't, because the market won't let us. And the market should regulate price, not the Missouri Merchandising Practices Act or this court. That's not where this court should go. And I say maybe that would be a bold statement to presume to tell this court what to do. I would only say look to what your peers, your colleagues across the country have done. And the point is they've said this is not our bailiwick. And most recently, the state of Indiana just last December and their Supreme Court addressed this question. But to answer your question that you posed earlier, what he's saying is we ought to get what the Medicare people get, even though Dr. Hoover isn't eligible for Medicare. We ought to get what United Healthcare will pay. We ought to get what Coventry. He chose not to buy the insurance.
I think he wants to know what the charges are, what they are specifically, so they figure out whether they're fair or not fair.
Then you should ask. Very simple. And just as you would ask, Judge, if you drove into your dealership to get your car fixed. I'm sorry?
What he wants to do is ask.
Well, but my point is he's claiming that he has been wrong because he wasn't told when he went in there what it was going to be. How does the hospital admission clerk say, oh, well, we're going to guess what Dr. Smith is going to do for you. We're going to know every lab test, every medication, every possible course of treatment, and then they're subject to the modalities of the care. How is the patient's condition going to evolve? But we're supposed to know that at the outset. If you want to know, ask your doctor what he wants done now. We'll be pleased to tell you the price, just like you'd ask what the price was if you walked into the car dealer and were going to get maintenance on your vehicle. That's all you got to do. They could have done that here. What he is not entitled to is to claim that, you know what, I chose not, this doctor chose not to buy this coverage. So, but what he says now is, I want the benefit of the coverage that those who bought it did. And if I would say to you, if that's allowed and you think you countenance that, then why would anybody buy insurance? Why not just say, look, I don't have to. I can get the benefit of the bargain that that other company's insurance guy got with that hospital. Or I can just go ahead and rely upon that I'll be eligible for Medicare, even though I'm not eligible for Medicare. I should get what Medicare is willing to pay.
Of course, his argument is that since 90, he hasn't done discovery, but between 94 and 98% of people don't pay the recall standard charges. They're not actually standard. And that that's what's misleading. And that's the premise of the area. Whether or not that's a valid cause of action or something that's very recognized is not.
Your Honor, the reason why 90% don't pay standard is because 90% have insurance. The fact, though, is if you go to an out-of-network provider, your insurance company is going to pay standard charges, and ma'am, you will pay a higher copay. That's the way the system, the indemnity system, has been set up. You may want to change that, but I think that's across the street. And I just want to refer the court to a couple of things that I think are important. And I think this is what Judge Robertson said, and obviously, and you all know this, it's the most quoted case in Missouri jurisprudence, ITT Commercial, where the federal courts now use discovery to identify the facts upon which the plaintiff's claim rests, such as in the Celotex case, that has not been the role of pleadings in Missouri. Finally, where the federal courts rely on summary judgment procedures to dispose of baseless claims, like in Celotex, such continues to be the role of motions to dismiss in Missouri.
Judge Wilson, very much aware of that.
Probably the only decision that Judge Robertson wrote that was never changed, the initial draft. Just that I kind of heard that somewhere. I don't know.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Judge.
Excellent job.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You coming before us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. President. With all due respect.
With all due respect. Mr. Allred said that in 30 states, this cause of action hasn't been recognized. Those 30 states don't have Missouri's Merchandising Practices Act, and that's irrelevant.
Well, Counsel, where in the act does it say that your client is only entitled or required to pay a reasonable amount for service?
The act doesn't say that, Judge. The act says that the act, use, or employment of any deception, fraud, false pretense, false promise, misrepresentation or concealment, suppression or omission of any material fact in connection with the sale is illegal and prohibited.
Did you believe that it was concealed?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, Judge, I would go further.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Where? Because that's not the paragraph that we're talking about.
Well, Judge, they talk about the conclusory paragraph, paragraph 46. Look at paragraph 39A through S, in which we talk about how the charge master is established arbitrarily and capriciously. Look at how we allege that Medicare pays less, that health insurance carriers. Excuse me?
We're only to concealment or misrepresentation.
The patients don't know that everyone pays a different charge and that if they're deemed to be uninsured, they will pay a higher rate than everyone else pays. Your original question was, where does the act say that you have to pay a fair and reasonable price? It doesn't. The law says that when you sign a contract of adhesion that doesn't specify a price, you're only required to pay what is fair and reasonable.
It's a contract of adhesion when you could have gone to any other hospital or didn't show that they followed.
It's a contract of adhesion because it doesn't specify a price. My friend, Mr.
Contract of adhesion means you have no choice to sign it.
Judge, I would ask you to look at the restatement of contracts on that. And what you will see is what the contract doesn't specify a price. The law imposes an obligation to pay.
But I think what you argued is if it's a contract of adhesion, the law will imply a fair and reasonable price. So that begs the question, is it a contract of adhesion? Because if it's
and
more generally so.
I believe that it's clearly a contract of adhesion.
If I understand, there's two different things. We've been mostly talking about basically standing to bring this by showing you're alleged you paid more than a fair and reasonable price. Then you have separate allegations as to whether and why it's an MMPA violation because you're alleging misrepresentation and omission and so forth.
Yes, Judge. All of those things are in the petition. I do not claim to be a legal genius. But I was well schooled on how to draft a petition. And I alleged that the Missouri Merchandising Practices Act makes certain things unlawful. And then I alleged the actions of the defendants which meet those requirements. I know how to plead a claim and cause of action and did so. And there is no question that any reasonable person who looks at this petition will say, he pled a cause of action. He might lose, but he pled a cause of action.
Does your claim depend on our finding the contract of adhesion?
My claim, I will go out on a limb and say this. If this court finds that that contract allows a hospital to bill patients whatever the heck they want, then my claim fails.
But what are you addressing is you agree to pay standard charges, and what that standard is unknowable, or you don't know, or you could put a website, the standard was misrepresented. Or you could plead it from that, or you could prove it from that, on the mechanism versus the
Judge, my point is this. They hold themselves out as a charitable, religious, tax-exempt organization. Don't people have a right to think that they'll be charged a fair and reasonable amount by a religious, charitable, tax-exempt organization? He says, you agree to pay $30,000 for a car and then somebody buys 30 of them for $27,000. The difference is that you knew the price. You knew the price in his example. That's not this case. Here, the patient assumes this Mercy Hospital with all these nuns walking around is going to charge me what's fair and reasonable, and then they get the bill. And I can prove that it's not fair and reasonable. Thank you.
Thank you. The case will be well argued. The case will be taken under advisement.